From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll look at why a lot of people won't run for political office, and those who do are, well...
We really aren't sending the best and brightest to our capitals, whether it's Lansing or Washington.
Then GM's corporate culture after ignition switch defect and under CEO Mary Barra.
I think she's going to try to use this crisis as an opportunity to drive some pretty dramatic change.
And a little history, the world-transforming rise of electricity.
Gas lamps were not very bright. They cast kind of a dim glow on the streets, so it required a lot of gas lamps to effectively light the streets.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. We've all heard about the General Motors ignition switch fiasco, blamed for at least 13 deaths and dozens of car accidents. So far, GM CEO Mary Barra has dismissed 15 employees over the delayed recall. But as her predecessor Dan Akerson told the Detroit News last week, the defective ignition switch was a clarion call for change within the company. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, the long process of repairing GM's flawed corporate culture from the inside out. But first, a week from today, August 5th, it's primary election day in Michigan. Lately, I've been reading, well, not just about who's on the ballot, but who is not on the ballot, and about the mediocrity of some of those candidates. Joining me now are Nolan Finley, the editorial page editor at Detroit News, and Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Hi, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nolan, I was reading you're not impressed with some or maybe many of those who are running for the state legislature and Congress. What's your concern?
Well, you know, we do this, go through this process every couple of years where we send out questionnaires and interview candidates as we try to determine who we're going to endorse, who we're going to support in the elections. And it just struck me as I was doing these interviews and looking at their answers to the questionnaires that we really aren't sending the best and brightest to our capitals, whether it's Lansing or Washington. I mean, we tend to think of Congress as this elite institution, and we treat the Congress people as if they're something very special. And you start sitting down and talking to the people who are running for the office, and even to the people who will ultimately win, and there's is a great deal of mediocrity.
Do you think that's really new? I mean, I've met some members of Congress. I thought, wow, maybe you should have stayed as a wrestling coach at a high school.
Yeah, I mean... I'm sure it's been going on for a long time. I think it's particularly acute in our state now. I think our leadership pool is as shallow as it's ever been. I would blame term limits for much of it. I think we don't give some of our promising lawmakers a chance to develop into something more special.
Jack, you recently talked about people who are not running. Why bring up people who aren't on the ballot?
Well, I think it's sort of an indication of what Nolan said, that there's a lot of strong people out there and who don't want the aggravation. And frankly, it's hard to blame them. As Nolan said, term limits mean, for example, you can be a state legislator for a maximum of 6 years in the state house, 8 in the Senate. And the sums that are being spent these days are frankly crazy. A state legislator makes a $71,000-something a year. In my own state Senate district, one of the challengers, in fact, a woman who's an underdog, has already spent more than $200,000 for trying to win a term. And plus that, if you're running for any office, the higher the office, the more the chances are that if you wet your pants in the third grade, someone's going to find out about it and talk about it. And a lot of people just don't want that aggravation.
You know, you both brought up term limits. I've thought redistricting and term limits both contribute to the reluctance of people to run for office because the political extremes at each end of the spectrum, the fact that just about the time an elected legislator really understands the complexities of running state government, they're forced out. I'm wondering if you think those two combine to really put off people. Nolan?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think definitely term limits do, and I think, as Jack said, the cost, both in terms of your reputation and your wallet, to run for these offices, you really got to do it. I mean, I talked to Dave Trott, who has been a very successful CEO, used to high-level decision-making, and accustomed to, when he wants something done, getting it done. And I asked him, I said, I just can't see how you're going to be happy going to Washington and working with 435 other people in one of the most dysfunctional committees in the world where nothing ever gets done. You know, people have these grand ideas. I want to make a difference. I want to change. And the reality is so little is getting done today. So little is getting changed because of the dysfunction of our institutions.
I'm wondering what you think about the redistricting part of that.
Well, I don't really see how redistricting plays into folks not wanting to step up and run for office or the more competent people wanting to step up and run for office. I think the fact that once you are elected, it's such a frustrating position to be in, and people look and they see that and they wonder, why do I want to be a part of this process?
And that I disagree a bit with Nolan, because I think redistricting in many cases means that good people, for example, I live in a state Senate district that is solidly and overwhelmingly Democratic. Are there some good Republicans here, some Republicans with ideas? Sure. Would they run for the state legislature? Not unless they're crazy or have some masochistic complex, because no Republican could win in this district. Now, if you live in Holland, Michigan, say, you could be Franklin D. Roosevelt, you could be the brightest, you could be John F. Kennedy, and you have no chance of being elected as a Democrat. So I think that also sort of factors people out. We should have more swing districts, and I think it would make both parties better, just the way Japanese competition, like it or not, made American cars better.
Jack, I think, you know, what you might be saying is we're seeing people farther and farther at the ends of the political spectrum because of redistricting. I mean, is that the problem?
Well, you said that's part of the problem, and I neglected to say that. What you have is people in primaries running who are, you know, they're trying to get the most excitable voters out. Most people don't vote in primaries. If we get a 25% turnout next week, it'll exceed expectations. And people who are so sort of more ideologically committed come out. Sometimes you get sort of very left-wing or very labor-oriented people, more than the average voter in Democratic districts. In a place like, remember, Congressman Joe Schwartz, great military record endorsed by President Bush, lost to a sort of proto-Tea Party guy in the Republican primary for Congress a few years ago. So, yeah, I think that's a big factor, too.
Nolan, you wrote that the hope is we'll pick a candidate who will rise to the position, will grow in stature, maturity, and pragmatism. But it's a crapshoot. Why do you say that?
It is. Well, because you look at particularly some of our congressional candidates this time for some of these open seats, and I wouldn't describe hardly any of them as being, you know, top of their game, being ready. I mean, we endorsed in the Detroit district to replace Peters. We endorsed Rudy Hobbs, a promising young lawmaker, but I would have preferred if he had, you know, 8-10 more years under his belt and a lot more experience. I think he would have been had a little more confidence and been a little more self-assured going into Congress. If he does win, then he will now.
I think Rudy Hobbs is a good example. I think may think he's a little stronger than Nolan does. But one other problem is, you look, Mike Rogers, whether you share his politics or not, is a very intelligent, very capable, hardworking member of Congress. He's leaving Congress to go be host of a radio talk show. Now, that may say something about you know, what his career path is going to be, but it also says something, I think, about the culture of Washington. I can't imagine 20, 30, 40 years ago, it would have been a Saturday Night Live parody, somebody giving up a powerful position in Congress to be the host of a talk show, but that's what he's doing.
I read a recent Macomb Politics blog by Chad Selesky. He says voters don't have much to choose from because many incumbents are not being challenged. And he says it's about too much money, the huge amount of time needed on the campaign trail, and just how nasty these campaigns are getting. I'm wondering if you agree with that point.
Well, yeah, I think that touches on everything we've been talking about. It's just we haven't created a very attractive environment for our candidates and for the people who have a lot of other options. You know, look around and say, why do this?
Jack?
You know, I think that's exactly right. I was just thinking, journalists generally don't run for office. When they do, they lose, and they probably shouldn't. But if you take a man like Nolan Finley or my wretched self, let's say, you know, if we decided to retire in a few years, we would be probably excellent state legislators in a lot of ways, only from the standpoint that we know a lot of stuff. We talked about these issues. We're probably vastly more informed than the average state legislator. But we wouldn't do that. First of all, we're poor journalists. And I don't know about Nolan, but I have a constitutional inability to ask people to give me money. And I think that's true in a lot of other walks of life. I think there are a lot of people out there who could be tapped for very useful service who, because of the nature of the process, what it's become, are never going to think about doing that.
What's it going to take to recruit smart people who really care about governing for the betterment of all citizens of Michigan? Nolan?
I don't know, but to Jack's point, I'd only run if all the skeletons in my closet could register and vote.
I'd win by a landslide.
So how are we going to recruit good people under the rules that we have?
We got to recruit them. We got to vote for them. And I think there's a responsibility here we haven't talked about much, and that is on the electorate to recognize good, competent people, not be swayed so much by these ridiculous campaigns that are being run today. I've been watching the ads in the Senate race. You got two decent people running for Senate, and you would think that you've got Jack the Ripper and Attila the Hun on the ballot here. The way these ads, every ad, it sets out to destroy somebody's reputation, and that's just absurd. And what's more absurd is that we respond to it. And so you have to put responsibility on the voters too.
I think that voters could do, it's sort of odd to be hectoring people about what to do, but if you look at both in Detroit News and the Detroit editorial page in the last 2 days, I think the News on Saturday, Free Press on Sunday, has sort of thoughtful endorsements of the various candidates, and they sort of explained their thinking. I didn't agree with either paper on all of them, but you can see where they're coming from, and they sort of give reasons. And I think if you educate yourself, and the good thing about the internet is there are more places to find out information about the candidates ever. There's websites like Publius and Ballotpedia. And, if you're complaining about it, go out, learn something about the various candidates, educate yourself, and talk to your neighbors.
Jack Lesenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Nolan Finley is the editorial page editor at the Detroit News. Thanks for your insights, guys.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It seems today technology is changing so fast. I mean, we've got new phones, we've got new kinds of cars, we've got advances in computer software and apps, but these changes are not as life-changing, and they are not as fast as technological changes that took place in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, imagine, we went from water wheel power and candles and whale oil lamps to electric motors and light bulbs in almost no time at all. Electricity really changed cities, and Detroit was widely considered one of the best lighted cities in the world today. If you contrast that with what's going on now, it's quite a difference. Our guest, Amy Elliott Bragg, recently wrote an article about electricity and Detroit that was published in Model D. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start before electricity came to Detroit. The city did have a couple of attempts to light some of the streets in the city. How'd that go?
Well, it didn't go so well, although you have to admire them for trying. The first experiment in lighting the streets in Detroit happened in the mid-1830s with a plan to kind of pilot some whale oil-fueled street lamps on Jefferson Avenue. They installed about 20 of them. The city council then called to add 20 more, but they never installed them. The lamps were lighted for about 3 months, and then they fizzled. Literally
that,
and figuratively.
Kind of a failed experiment there. But then they stumbled onto, and they didn't stumble onto it, a lot of cities were going to gas lamps, mm-hmm. and that worked a little better, I guess.
It did. Actually, it worked really well, and it worked for nearly 30 years. The first gas lamps in Detroit came in the early 1850s, I believe about 1851. And that was how streets were lit, right up until the late 1870s when the electric light first started to appear.
But there were some drawbacks to these gas lamps.
Sure. The gas lamps required lamp lighters, as many people maybe romantically remember. And those people were city employees, or they were employed by the gas company, so it was labor intensive to light the lights. Although when the gas lamps went away, a lot of people complained that they would lose their jobs lighting the lamps in the evenings. And gas lamps were not very bright. They cast kind of a dim glow on the streets, so it required a lot of gas lamps to effectively light the streets. And it was kind of a shadowy era. If anyone has ever been to New Orleans and seen the sort of flickering gas lamps, you can get a sense mm-hmm. for how they were both beautiful and perhaps impractical.
Now, you wrote that Detroit's introduction to electric lights first came with the circus. How did that happen?
Well, electric lights in the early days, especially before the incandescent light, were kind of novelty items. So a traveling circus came to Detroit in 1879, and its main attraction were its electric chandeliers, which were an early kind of electric light called an arc light. Mm-hmm. So they were noisy.
They still use them for searchlights.
They do, yes. They're extremely bright and kind of noisy. But it was an attraction that people wanted to come see, a novelty item.
Well, speaking of arc lights, the Brush Electric Light Company took a new approach to lighting Detroit. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is my favorite story about early electric lighting in Detroit because it seems so fantastical. But the Brush Electric Light Company won a contract from the city of Detroit to install lighting towers. So these were, they kind of remind me in pictures, they look kind of like phone towers that we see today.
So we're talking really tall.
Extremely tall, maybe 100, 120 feet high. Some accounts say they were as many as 200 or 300 feet high, although I have kind of a hard time believing that. But the towers were 120 feet tall, maybe topped with a ring of arc lights that would cast a glow across an entire block or an entire public intersection. And they installed about 120 of them, I believe, when they were first under contract with the city. They were known as moonlight towers because the light that they cast was so bright that it looked like the moon rising over your entire neighborhood. People complained that they were noisy or that they cast a glare. They were too bright. Some people said they couldn't sleep with the lights sort of shining in their window all night. And in other neighborhoods, especially kind of in the then suburban areas of Detroit, the tree cover was so dense that the lights just shone on top of the trees and illuminated the leaves.
Sure. All you got was shadow. You didn't really get much light. So how did Detroit evolve from these lighted towers to streetlights?
At the time of the lighting towers, there were a number of electrical interests in Detroit, a number of different companies providing power for the streetlights. The city actually created its own municipal power plant at the time to sort of have better control and serve the public more effectively. That was in the mid-1880s. The Edison Illuminating Company in Detroit was the only electric company providing power to incandescent lamps in Detroit, which people preferred and which were kind of a status symbol in some ways, to have an incandescent light in your home. And the proliferation of electricity and electric companies created a lot of competition. It drove up a lot of demand. And it eventually led to, and this happened across the country, the consolidation of lots of small electric companies. So in Detroit, those kind of competing smaller companies were bundled up into the Edison Illuminating Company in Detroit, which became Detroit Edison. So
right.
Detroit Edison was able to drive demand for and kind of wide-scale adoption of incandescent lamps in Detroit.
I found your article really interesting considering what's going on in Detroit right now. I mean, we had something like 88,000 mercury vapor lights or these sodium lights, high-pressure sodium lights, up to 40% of them out. And now Detroit is doing another lighting revolution, and it's going to be leading one of the leading cities for the transition to LED streetlights.
Absolutely. It's a really exciting time to be understanding what's going on, which was part of what inspired the story. When you think about what is the future going to look like in Detroit for both electric lighting and public utility, but also as we start to have conversations about the future of renewable energy, what we will do about reducing our carbon footprint, all of these issues are interrelated and, to me, intimately connected to the history that we have as a forward-thinking and very innovative culture in Detroit. So certainly the LED streetlight program is something to watch.
Amy Elliott Bragg is the author of the article, How the Rise of Electricity Transformed Urban Life in Detroit. It was published in Model D. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
You know, earlier this month I was at home straining my eyes to read this fascinating Forbes article on my phone. The title was How to Blow $9 Billion, The Fallen Stroh Family. It told the story of this rise and fall of a Michigan brewing family and was written by Carrie A. Dolan, and she joins us now. First, what got you interested in writing about the Strohs?
You know, I was lucky enough to actually be pitched this story. The public relations person for Francis Stroh, who's a fifth generation member of the family, lives here in San Francisco where I am. She's writing a novel, excuse me, a memoir, and she was looking for a little, I don't know, publicity ahead of the memoir. So I talked to her, and it just so happened that I was very interested because Forbes was in the process of putting together a list of the richest families in America, large family fortunes. And the Stroh family had been on a sort of a smaller list that we'd done back in the 80s of great family fortunes when their brewery was at its peak. And, of course, they fell off as, you know, situation declined at the brewery.
Let's do just a sketch of what happened to the family. You know, it starts in the mid-19th century, an immigrant and a beer recipe, and then it grew from there. How did they get big first?
They grew pretty slowly and steadily from, you know, the late 1800s on. Bernard Stroh came from Germany, as you said, with the recipe and started out delivering, you know, the beer with the wheelbarrow. But delivering beer, you know, had eventually the automobile, and they were able to expand their distribution in the Midwest. And then the growth really happened in the 80s. By then, fourth generation family member Peter Stroh was the CEO. Someone had told me, I was never able to verify this, that they paid a lot of money to McKinsey for a study that said, you know, you either have to get big or get out of the business.
And so then they did get big, too. Three to only Anheuser-Busch and Miller.
Exactly. And this was after in the early 80s, they bought first Schaefer Brewery, and then the big one in 1982 was Joseph Schlitz Brewery, which was, as a couple of other family members told me, it was like a minnow swallowing a whale. I mean, Stroh had one brewery in Detroit, and Schlitz had six around the country. They became a national brand, I mean, a national company with lots of brands, Old Milwaukee, Schlitz Malt Liquor, you know, the Stroh's brand. But they didn't have the marketing budget to compete with the two bigger guys, Anheuser-Busch and Miller. And then also, at the same time, Coors was slowly moving eastward from Colorado, expanding its distribution, and they had, you know, fewer brands, and they could focus, and they had more money. A lot about beer is marketing, as I learned in reporting the story.
So we had a lot of debt from buying out other companies. We had some not great marketing, especially when they missed on light beer, which I understand, according to your article, that happened. And they got this new competition from Coors. That kind of is where the whole Stroh's family story starts to unravel, right?
Yeah, I mean, as one of the former employees I talked to told me, he said there were four big breweries in a three-brewery industry because there really was only room in the market for three breweries. And what happened was, you know, there were price wars. Stroh started introducing 30 beers for the price of 24, 30 packs and 15 packs, 15 beers for the price of 12, and that kind of stuff. So,
sure,
you know,
cheapening the brand, yeah.
Exactly. And then, in a kind of an about face, Peter Stroh brought in this ad guy, Hal Reiney, who decided, no, the brand needed a makeover. We're going to make Stroh's into a premium beer. It never was a premium beer. But they got new label, same recipe, raised the price, and the sales of the beer tanked because it was the same beer, but it cost more. They got rid of the 30 packs and everything. So some mistakes that were done. And then I think what happened that was the real problem was in the mid-90s, in 96, they took on more debt to buy yet another company, G. Heilemann. And that had a whole bunch of kind of second-tier brands. And by the time, and meanwhile, they weren't using full capacity at their plant. They were contract brewing for lots of other folks, including Pabst. And then Pabst decided not to renew the contract for having Stroh brew their beer. And that was, as I was told by some people, that might have been the final blow that kind of forced the company into selling. So they sold Stroh's. I mean, you may still be able to get Stroh's somewhere. You certainly can't get it here in California. But Pabst bought a bunch of the brands, and Miller bought some of the brands, and most money went to pay down the debt that they took on.
Your title suggests blowing $9 billion,
yes,
but that's not what the Stroh family got. Yeah,
it's a hyperbolic thing. So we say in the first paragraph of the story that in 1988, Forbes calculated that the family fortune shared by about 30 members was worth at least $700 million. And so if they had matched the S&P 500, you know, since then, that they'd be worth about $9 billion. So, you know, there's a lot of theoretical
right. And so,
made to get to that $9
billion. What did the family end up getting out of the company once it was sold off?
Private company, so they didn't have to disclose it. But the sources that I talked to in the family say about $100 million. And some of that went to a fund to pay the pensions for the workers. And then the rest of that went to the family. And there were a bunch of family members. You know, there were like at least 35, 40 family members.
So this was a family that in the 80s and the 90s were living the life of very wealthy people who now are adjusting their lifestyles, I assume.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's poverty stricken. I mean, one of the family members that I talked to, Greg Stroh, who, you know, all his life he wanted to work for his family company. He did work at the Stroh Brewery for, I think, about 8 years. And then he moved to Colorado, and he started Izzy Soda. He's a co-founder of Izzy Soda, and he's actually now on his third startup. He's done great. He took what he learned working for his family company and applied it to other kinds of businesses. And, you know, somebody else has written a book, and the woman I talked to here in San Francisco, was a Fulbright scholar and studied art. I mean, it's not like these people are on the dole somewhere, but they were living the country club life in the gated community on Grosse Pointe Farms, you know, on Provencal Road. So it was, you know, life was pretty good.
That's Carrie A. Dolan. She's assistant managing editor at Forbes and the author of an article called How to Blow $9 Billion, The Fallen Stroh Family. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
The western end of Lake Erie, especially near Toledo, is seeing a lot of algae this year. It's been worse, but this year is larger than average, and we're seeing blue-green algae. Now, that's a bacteria that can produce a toxin. It can make you sick if you swim in it. It can make your pets sick. It's a problem for water purification plants and drinking water, too. We wanted to talk to Don Scavia. He's the director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan. He's also an aquatic ecologist. Don, you keep tabs on this algal bloom. Let's put this in perspective. When Lake Erie was considered dead back in the 1960s and 70s, these algae blooms were a contributing factor to that, right?
They were. Both in the western basin of Lake Erie, where these blooms that are occurring now were happening, but also in the central basin, and those algal blooms that caused the dead zone in the central basin were key to declaring, inappropriately, but declaring the lake dead back then.
So it's not as bad as then. It's not even as bad as it was back in 2011, which was kind of record-breaking for the last decade or so. Why is it a concern this year?
Well, the models that we use to forecast what it's going to be like later on this summer are based on the amount of phosphorus coming into the Western Basin, primarily through the Maumee River. And the loads were quite a bit above average this year. And so the forecasts are that the bloom, as it evolves into August and September, is going to be, you know, significantly larger than average, but not nearly the size of the 2011 catastrophe.
Now, sewer plants and farming practices are the main culprits in dumping nutrients into the rivers that feed into Lake Erie, such as Maumee. But the Toledo sewer plant was supposed to be upgraded. Has that happened?
I don't know the specifics about the Toledo plant, but I do know that in response to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement back in the 70s and actions in the 80s, that most of the sewer treatment plants were upgraded in the region, and most of the phosphorus loading into Lake Erie now is coming from what's called non-point sources, that is not coming out of individual pipes from treatment plants, but rather coming off the agricultural lands.
So this is chiefly from overuse of fertilizer by Ohio farmers.
It's from agriculture. It's from over-fertilizing in some cases. It's from changes in agricultural practices that have changed the kind of phosphorus that's going into the lake that we're just trying to understand now what's caused that and what we need to do to address it.
Why can't we get farmers to reduce fertilizer running off farm fields?
Well, you know, there has been a lot of effort over a fair amount of time to try to improve that situation. There's even more coming up now out of the new parts of the newly reauthorized farm bill. One of the issues is that most of the agricultural conservation practices that have been put in place over the last several decades have focused on soil erosion, keeping particulate phosphorus that goes along with the sediment on the land and not getting into the lake. And it's been quite successful in doing that. But that, coupled with some other practices and coupled with the climate-induced massive storms that we're seeing in the spring, is now producing a situation where we're having dissolved phosphorus getting into the lake, which is not something we saw much of before. It's tripled since the mid-90s. And it's this new form of phosphorus that we don't have great agricultural practices to protect against yet. And so that's where the focus is now, is how to keep that form of phosphorus out of the lake.
So it's these supercell storms that are drenching really fast and picking up the nitrogen and carrying it off.
Absolutely, and it's phosphorus in this case. It's nitrogen that matters a lot more in the marine environment, but it's phosphorus here, and it is these massive storms that are really flushing the land much more than it had in the past.
Is this related to climate change?
Very much so. I mean, this trend in the increased storms has been documented over the last decade or two, have increased 50, 60, 70% in this region, and most of the climate models are projecting that to continue to increase into the future.
So are there any quick fixes for this?
The quick fixes are to implement what's called four R's in agriculture, making sure the fertilizer is put on in the right amount, at the right time, in the right place, in the right way, to try to keep this dissolved phosphorus from getting into the lake.
Okay, that's Don Scavia. He's the director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. GM has been in the news a lot, probably more than it wants to be. And Daniel Howes, the business columnist at the Detroit News, wrote about the automaker's struggle to overhaul its culture in the wake of failed parts, recalls, government criticism, and some tough questions from Congress. Daniel, you described the insidious aspects of GM's corporate culture as decades of blame shifting, lack of accountability, a callous disregard for customers. Has going through bankruptcy and the new leadership of GM had any impact on that corporate culture?
Not enough, I think it's probably safe to say, and I think the evidence is in the report, the internal report that was commissioned by GM on this whole mess, which talks about the culture and the attitude towards this problem that has now become one of the biggest problems the industry's seen, and certainly that General Motors has faced. And some of that did happen, and that narrative did occur after the 2009 bankruptcy. I think one of the things that's interesting is there's this assumption by people on the outside, starting with the federal government and the Obama Automotive Task Force, that if you just put some different people on the board of directors and you put some new CEO and new senior management, that you could change this culture. That may be necessary, but I think we now know that it's really not sufficient. It's going to take a much longer-term approach that is a lot more consistent and shows a lot more discipline. Remember, GM's had five CEOs in 5 years. In that time frame, Ford Motor Company had one in 8 years, as an example, and kept its management team largely intact throughout that whole period. So Al Mulally was able to kind of, through iteration and discipline and really fine-tuning, able to get a system of accountability well established at Ford Motor Company. Now, I think the management of GM wants to get there. I really do. But the question is, are they going to be able to?
It sounds like in your column that you were really thinking they ought to look at middle management a little more carefully, find out more about who hid the ignition switch problems, which led to the deaths of 13 people. Am I misreading here?
No, but going back to the early to mid-'80s, Roger Smith was famously the CEO of General Motors and at the time complained about what he called the frozen middle. That's his words, not mine. And it was a frustration of the inability to reach into the anonymous ranks of the salaried workforce primarily and how difficult it was to drive change. GM had a history even as recently as last year, frankly, when Dan Akerson was finishing his three-year stint of demoting salaried people who weren't performing as opposed to getting rid of them, of moving problems around. This was a management culture. He complained to me in an interview in December of what he called a management union, whereby middle managers had this about the same security as members of the United Auto Workers, if not more so. And in his view, that was not something that just compounds problems. And he told the story of a young up-and-comer who came to him and really wanted to ascend to higher levels in the company. But the guy above him had been demoted and was basically standing in his way. And it created a real bottleneck. And that's been a real frustration. So there's a lot of issues internally that we don't see on the outside, and customers certainly don't see, that can affect the performance and affect the culture.
You write that new CEO Mary Barra is taking smart first steps, but Barra is a longtime GM insider. How can an insider get other company insiders to change GM's corporate culture?
Well, I think she's using, or I think she's going to try to use this crisis as an opportunity to drive some pretty dramatic change. I mean, in fairness, Mary is a product of the culture, but she also has got a pretty well-established reputation of driving change and getting people to work together and to achieve new kinds of levels. I think one of the big questions for her is going to be, can she train that discipline on people that she's been close to? I think one of the truisms of the General Motors leadership today, as we sit here 5 or so years out of bankruptcy, is that it's more populated by longtime GM people than it's been since bankruptcy. And she has a close relationship with her head of product development. She's close to her head of communications. She's close to the general counsel who's been in the middle of this mess. And she defended him pretty fiercely after they both testified before the Senate committee a couple of weeks ago. And I'm not suggest. And she basically has made the case that I need him and I need him on the team. And that may or may not be true, but one of the ways you change cultures is by the way in which you handle personnel, who you appoint into and promote, how you compensate them, what you're willing to tolerate in terms of accountability or lack of accountability, and what you won't tolerate. And the history of GM has been that CEOs have stuck with people they've worked with for a much longer period of time than they probably should have. And I certainly saw that a lot when I was based in Germany and saw the guys that were running Europe and basically running Europe into the ground. And they stayed there for 5, 6, 7 years.
That's Daniel Howes. He's the business columnist at Detroit News. Thanks very much for telling me about this.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. So, talking GM and recalls, we were kind of wondering what that's meant for the dealers.
Service line one.
I stopped by Victory's Chevrolet Buick in Milan and talked to Sean Johnson about the recalls.
Well, it's a lot more business in the service end of it, you know, because the cars are coming in, they have to get fixed, they have to get taken care of. Negative-wise, I think people are just kind of scared, you know, to buy a GM product. I've had a couple phone calls from people saying that they're scared they don't want their daughters or their sons driving vehicles because of the ignition switches and, you know, fatalities. But other than that...
Well, you're getting people into the showroom, though. I mean, into the service bay, but that you got to kill some time, right?
Exactly. They come in, do it for a test drive. I mean, the GM products are phenomenal. It's just that, you know, there's a hiccup. I mean, I don't know any other way to really describe it. I'm not in that end of the business, only in the sales part of it, so I don't really know, you know, what happened at the plants, what happened with the people. I have no idea about that. All I know is that what's happening now. I was in service for a while, lots of business, lots of recalls.
That's good revenue for the dealership, though, right?
Well, of course it is. I mean, for any of the dealerships around, you know. Any Chevy dealership, it's going to be good revenue because you're bringing people in the building, and then you have the opportunity to show them the new products and maybe possibly get them in test drive and possibly sell them. I mean, you don't know.
You were talking about some people have had reservations. I mean, has it been really serious or just an occasional comment here and there?
An occasional comment, yeah. Nobody's stood up, you know, pushed them away. I had a couple phone calls. I talked to people, and they were just, you know, they're nervous. When you hear about fatalities in vehicles, that's not something you should take lightly.
Right. It's been a lot of media, news media on this. Everybody's aware of it. I mean, you'd have to be living in a cave not to have heard about it so far. But it doesn't sound like it's had a great impact on car sales.
No, yeah, you're right. You're right.
GM had a profitable quarter last quarter. It wasn't as profitable as they'd hoped, but that was because of all these recalls. So apparently some cars are moving off the lot.
Yeah, we're moving some cars off the lot. I mean, slowly but surely. I don't know how everyone else is doing as far as Chevy-wise, as far as the other dealerships go. But, yeah, I mean, it's slowly coming back around. I mean, people aren't as worried, aren't as afraid. And we have people specifically coming in for Cruises, for Malibus, for Equinoxes. I mean, stuff that's part of the recalls. These are the cars that people are buying. So I don't know. It's not me. I'm not reassuring everybody, so I don't know what's going on. But, yeah, people are coming in the building. But I think people are starting to not be as scared, I guess. Maybe if that makes sense.
I'm wondering if the CEO, the new CEO, Barra, has had some impact on that because she's been pretty forward about it, and they're issuing these recalls before they're asked to issue these recalls.
I think she's just preemptive strike, I'd imagine. I mean, that would be my guess. I would think that she's just trying to nip it in the bud before it gets anything else happens. I mean, basically, they see one fault, and it seems like, you know, like, oh, just recall it. You know, and then we fix it, and then we take care of the recall, and then the car's, you know, safety, it's ready to go, so I mean, there's no worries after that. I think she's just being cautious because of what happened.
I'm wondering if there's any carryover from at the time GM went bankrupt. There were a lot of complaints about it being government motors and so forth. You still hear much of that, or is that pretty well blown past by now?
No, I mean, anybody that's been loyal to GM, they stay loyal to GM. You know, I mean, yeah, there was talk about that. I've only been here a year, so what I've seen, I've not heard one thing about any kind of bailout, any kind of government motors. No, I mean, I've heard nothing. People that come in for Chevys or Buicks, they come in for Chevys and Buicks because they're loyal.
After we finished the interview, Sean Johnson started telling me what people should do if their vehicle has been recalled. I got to thinking, well, maybe you'd like to know that too.
You know, all I can say, I guess, with people is that if you have a recall, call us, have us order the part. We'll do everything in our power to get it done as fast as possible. Bring it in and be patient. I mean, the problem is that these recalls, they're coming in such a fast volume that we can't order the parts fast enough. We're not getting the parts from GM fast enough. So I've heard complaints like, well, it's been 2 weeks. Like, well, it's not us. It's not us. We're not getting the parts. So as far as the recalls go, you know, call, ask, talk to our service department. You know, any information that we have, we're open book. You want to talk to me. My name is Sean. Come call me. You know, I'll answer any questions that I can. And if I can't, I don't have an answer for you, I'll find out.
That's Sean Johnson. He's a salesperson at Victory Chevrolet Buick in Milan, talking about GM's recalls and how they affect the local dealerships. Primary elections are a week away, and with the retirement of Representative John Dingell, the 12th congressional district is an open seat. There's a contested primary for the heavily Democratic district. Running are the congressman's wife, Debbie Dingell, who I spoke with yesterday, and Ypsilanti attorney Raymond G. Mullins. Mullins and I began talking about the issues he's most concerned with.
People are not addressing the issue of African-American education, not to mention other poor children regardless of race. There are Appalachian whites in the 12 congressional districts. As a matter of fact, only 12% of the population of the 12 congressional district are African Americans. But poor people, lower middle class people, regardless of race, are not having the same access to education as are people who are more affluent. And plus, providing leadership. I mean, United States representative is a leader. Only 435 people, and they have an influence not only on the national government, but also on the state and the people that they are representing.
I want to ask you about some of the topics we've been touching on. Support for higher education and for K-12 education is key for Michigan to be economically competitive.
Pre-K-12.
Right, exactly. Or as the Governor Snyder says, P-20.
Yeah.
So what should the federal government be doing to make sure our kids and the workforce are getting what they need?
Well, there's certainly a team between state and federal, and primarily the states are the body that is primarily concerned with education. But as we have seen within the United States, the states have lagged behind, and there's a great disparity between the poor and the rich. And with charter schools that have come on and gutted the public school system, I'm an advocate of the public schools. My mom was a public school teacher. And the quality of education in Michigan has, in fact, gone down. There are some things that are happening with the federal government. The GI Bill is something I went through law school with. And prior to that time, other people attained higher degrees, you know, in the four-year colleges with various grants and Pell Grants, whatever. Those things have dried up. Plus, the rate of going to college has skyrocketed, to the point where people who graduate from college are taking, 30 to 40 years to pay off their loans. That's totally ridiculous, considering the fact that a person who graduates from college is going to be able to make a greater contribution, not only regarding talent, but also economically to our society.
Conflicting federal court rulings recently on Obamacare health insurance exchanges might be headed to the Supreme Court. It's likely Congress will eventually have to patch it if it's not completely scrapped by the new Congress. What's the best solution in your mind?
Well, I think it would be a tragedy if they scrap the program because many more people are covered by the Affordable Care Act at a lower rate. And it's just better for the general population. To scrap it would be totally ridiculous. Some people are opposed to Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. But, I mean, these are citizens. These are people of the United States. These are people. A lot of people have have worked hard in industry, and they need care. Now, I would think, and we knew going into the Affordable Care Act, that there was going to be some tweaking needed. And something that huge and large and concerned a lot of people, we knew that there were going to be things that needed to be fixed. But the overall object of it and the goal was to provide better health care for many more Americans that could not afford it beforehand.
The biggest issue in Michigan, of course, is more and better jobs. What do you think Congress should be doing to make sure that Michigan gets a better opportunity to make those things happen, more and better jobs?
Well, one of the things that – and I'm going after my opponent – is that she used to be on the board of General Motors. And she was on the board of General Motors when they closed those plants in Flint and sent those jobs to Mexico. There were at least 30,000, and their estimates now that 90,000 workers in the General Motors plants lost their jobs. And you saw the movie Roger and Me, and it showed how Flint, among others, but Flint primarily was devastated by General Motors closing those plants and sending them to Mexico. We have to look after our own people first. There's a lot of jobs being transported overseas. As a matter of fact, this bridge that they talk about building between Detroit and Windsor, I'm lobbying that if they do build a bridge, that we use American steel, that we use American workers. And I think the Oakland Bay Bridge in California was repaired primarily with Japanese steel or Asian steel, and that's not right. If money is earned here, it's going to be spent here, and we're going to be a much stronger society because of it.
I want to talk about the race itself for just a second. I was looking at the Federal Election Commission reports. It indicates last quarter you raised just under $5,000. Your mm-hmm. opponent at the same time raised $405,000. What does that tell you about the race?
It tells me she's got a lot more money than I have. But in Eric Cantor's case down in Virginia, he outspent his opposition 23-1. And
we're talking about 81-1 here, though.
Well, that's still a lot of money. And the fact that is, I think that she probably has upward toward $1 million because after she announced, they announced on this station and other station that she raised $500,000. And the average amount of money to run a congressional race, even against a viable opponent, is only like $230,000.
So what do you think of your chances on August 5th?
Well, the thing about it is that when I ran, and I apologize for diverting, is that on the 28th of March, circulated my petitions primarily in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor and was able to get the quota within less than 4 weeks. My speech was, I'm running against Debbie Dingell. People couldn't wait to sign my petition. There is some opposition in this congressional district to her just assuming the position because of her last name, her married last name. And we'll see what happens on Election Day, whether or not that will turn into something realistic that could support and help me.
That's Raymond G. Mullins. He's running for the Democratic nomination in the 12th Congressional District. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
And as I mentioned, I spoke with Debbie Dingell, who is also running in the Democratic primary. You can find that interview at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Peg Watson. The program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.